It's a very nice village, but it's a bit scattered. It's a bit scattered. Awfully scattered. It's a scattered community.
Now from the Academic Agency.
I'm here. Can people hear me? Press one if you can hear me. Hello, hello, hello. Yes. Press one. Well, a lot of people are putting two, so that's no good, is it? One. Excellent. All right, people can hear me. Okay. Right. All of last week, a set of 14 retrospectives signaling 6 years of this channel aired. There was a vote on which was the best one. I'm kind of iffy on whether I agree with that vote or not. And so I'm going to share with you the results, and then I'm going to go and review all 14 episodes. If you haven't watched them yet and you're a newcomer and all of this material is new to you, this may be a useful stream. I think I'll leave them up for about 4 weeks, give people a chance to watch them. Then they'll probably go behind the paywall. Let us begin. So, first of all, I'm going to share my this little presentation I've made. And I have devised this guide to the various eras of the channel. There are basically four different broad periods. There's the period, and each of them last, I would say, about 18 months to 2 years, if I was to give a rough time frame for each of the periods. So first there was the early anti-SJW period. My avatar in those days looked like that. It was designed by Shinobi Yaka. You all know Shinobi Yaka, of course. Yeah, I think Shinobi made that one. So during that period, which was featured in the retrospective, there was quite a lot of material from that period in some of the retrospectives, especially Deconstructing the Left. There was a lot of material, doing like basic bitch deconstructions of left-wing arguments, explaining what they were, developing tactics to counter them in debates and things like that. Okay. In this middle period here, from about, let's say, 2018 to 2019, I did a lot of economics on the channel. Now, I didn't include a huge amount of the economics material in the retrospectives because I just, they were like basic lessons, things like that. Some of my most watched videos actually were not included in the retrospective. There's one on Thomas Hobbes and absolute monarchy that I didn't include. There's one on the Chicago school versus the Austrian school that I didn't include. There's the whole Masters of Austrian Economics series I did not include. Tons of like little 5-minute economics lessons and things like that were not included. But much of that material was made in this in this based libertarian period. The phrase based libertarian, right, based libertarian, basically means that while I argued for Austrian economics on social issues during this period, and increasingly so during this period, I was much more conservative. In fact, I always have been relatively conservative on the social issues. In fact, one of the things that we could do is you could map real life books that I've written to each of these periods. So this early anti-SJW period, I wrote a book called Shakespeare's Moral Compass, which was based on the work of Jonathan Haidt and applying Haidt to Shakespeare. He even wrote the book on the back, and you can see a lot of my basic arguments, my philosophical underpinnings, came from the kind of Haidtian moral matrix model in that period. Then in this period, I wrote a book called The Defenders of Liberty: Human Nature, Individualism, and Property Rights, which I would still recommend reading that book, because while there's a lot of economics in there is some elite theory in there, and you will see it as my attempt basically to save classical liberalism or libertarianism from being gay and cringe, essentially. So I make the argument in there that to be a proper libertarian, you have to recognize and align yourself with what human nature is. I've got whole bits in that book about how human beings are groupish and how human beings are rational, and all of the way and the last chapter points all of the ways in which libertarianism went wrong, as it were, you know, the faith in mathematical modeling, its treatment of individuals as these kind of atomized units rather than as groupish social animals, and so on and so forth. So that was the base libertarian period. But I think it's really a matter of emphasis. In that period, I would still talk a lot about the root of the problem being things like the welfare state and socialism, as opposed to these days, where I tend to talk about the problem being an evil and corrupt set of elites. So, you know, there's a different emphasis in the analysis. So then in this period, 2019-2020, I've called it Shedding Boomer Truth. And that is where I really came to realize that the problem isn't really the existence of the welfare state or socialism per se. These are economic arguments, right? There's something much deeper. The problem is goes beyond a purely materialist analysis. If you follow the cigar streams during that period, we were reading Carlyle. I deepened my interest in elite theory, which I had already touched on as early as 2018. But the implications that elite theory has for libertarianism are significant, which I did point out back then. But I came to realize a lot of other implications. So the Shedding Boomer Truth period really is the journey for how we got here. But as you'll see in a moment, a lot of the highest rated material that people really enjoyed comes in that Shedding Boomer Truth period. And then now, from about 2021 to now, I've been, you know, I'm not keen on labels, as you know, and by putting inverted commas around postmodern traditionalist, that to me is kind of sums up where I am, which is that, I would prefer a traditionalist society and one that is natural and normal, but I also realize, being a realist, the reality of living in the postmodern condition and all of that entails. You know, if you have a look at the Forbidden Text, my Substack, it's called something like Base Thoughts About Surviving the Kali Yuga, or something like that, which is kind of where a lot of us are now, coming to peace with the fact that, you know, we're part of a big historical process here. And that historical process may easily not go the way we want it to as well. So anyway, let's have a look now at the votes. So using Excel, I ran a series of polls on YouTube, Twitter, and Telegram. I did run them on Gab as well, but for some reason I don't get a lot of engagement on Gab. I've got about 2,000 followers on Gab, but to give you an idea, these polls were getting like 9 responses and things like that, which is, you know, statistically insignificant. So I have not put Gab poll results on here. Yeah, we'll just have a look. I mean, group one was between Sadiq Khan, Tony Blair, and immigration. Immigration won that one, as you can see. What's interesting about these polls is that I don't think there was a single poll where any of the platforms voted in a different way, i.e. the winner of each poll also, the winner of the overall poll also won all of the individual polls, which is interesting. It means there's very much a true consensus among the different people who follow me in different places. So, I mean, Telegram may swing more towards some of the race stuff. Twitter may swing towards, you know, other areas, maybe. I don't know. But overall, basically everybody agreed. So On Immigration won the first group, squeaking out Tony Blair. Sadiq Khan was nowhere, only 7%, which is ironic because the Sadiq Khan series easily has the most number of views. If you go back to the original videos, there's one Sadiq Khan video with like 750,000 views. So this is, you know, Sadiq Khan's like my kind of Let's Dance or something, you know, Bowie record that sold a lot, but typically is not thought of in a particularly fond way, or something like Tonight, maybe like that. Group two, you can see On Degeneracy beat American Race and Deconstructing the Left, which to me was a little bit of a surprise. I'll get onto that in a moment. I'm not convinced that's the best out of those three, but viewers disagreed. Then in group three, this was a very, you know how in the World Cup there's often like a group of death. This was a very difficult group to be in. Econ Shots basically stood no chance in this sort of company. But On Economic History, which going into the retrospectives, a lot of people said was the, you know, the best stuff I'd done, their favorite ever material. It got absolutely smashed by the Boomer Truth regime in this group. And then On Managerialism, which is also a pretty important series I did, also got smashed by the Boomer Truth regime. So there's a kind of quirk of these groupings, because had Economic History or Managerialism been in one of these other groups, they may well have won and ended up in the final. But as it was, they were out in the first round. And then the final group, you've got Critiquing Libertarianism beat On Containment and On Strategy and Tactics, which also surprised me a little bit. I was surprised by that. Then again, if I was to say, looking at people's comments about the stuff that really sticks with people, it's the stuff that actually succeeded in changing people's minds. Okay, so For example, critiquing libertarianism, there were a lot of comments saying, oh, this was the video that saved me from libertarianism. I stopped being a libertarian after this one. You know, they actually changed their mind. On the Boomer Truth regime, I got even more extreme comments like, oh, this series changed my life. This series, you know, ended up put me on the road to having a divorce with my wife. So, I really hope the Boomer Truth regime didn't ruin your marriage, mate. But, you know, what I'm saying is that when videos lead somebody to have a road to Damascus conversion, people tend to rate those ones higher. Whereas let's say the economic history series, they're kind of all written from a kind of free market point of view. And in a way, they're preaching to the choir. Like, I'm not sure if anybody ever sat down and watched Economic History who was like a leftist and, you know, had a road to Damascus conversion watching those. I don't know, though. I don't know. People were shocked by the On Degeneracy series. They said things like, because I basically linked the... I showed empirically, basically, the harms, the real harms done by degenerate lifestyles in things like STD data. There's a bit where I go back to the Weimar Republic and talk about why conservative revolutions have happened in the past and things like that. So, people seem to think that On Degeneracy was an eye-opener, whereas something like America and Race, well... kind of everybody knows there's an issue there, if that makes any sense. Let us continue. So this was the final rankings by the people. Who said democracy works at anybody? So I'll just go down to the final rankings. Incidentally, the Solid Snake avatar was designed by Froggy, who used to be a frequent guest on Unpopular Opinions. If I should have mentioned, this is just a shot of George Sanders that people started using quite a lot. Like, there was a lot of memes made with this image because he was wearing a black shirt and he looks kind of, there's a certain aesthetic there, let's just say. This one was made by Froggy. This one was made by Shinobi Aka. This one on the right was part of a series made by Oliver Semyagog. He also made the Lenin one, the Mao one, and the Ayatollah Khomeini one. So, Semyagog has done great work. A lot of people like the Solid Snake. I guess to mark this era, we've been using the Semyagog ones. So, So Boomer Truth regime handily won, as we saw with the stats. On Immigration came second and On Degeneracy came third. Critiquing Libertarianism came fourth. When I shared these results earlier on social media, people were saying, like, what the hell is wrong with the crowd? Like, they have not chosen the like that, you know. A lot of people want the economic history higher, managerialism higher, and think the immigration one is too high, basically. So we'll get on to what I think in a moment, but interesting. Tony Blair made the top five, which makes me pleased. He was knighted yesterday. Did anybody see Tony Blair knighted? There's pictures of him doing the rounds, basically, and there was a massive protest outside where he was poncing about in his robes. So that's the final thing. Sadiq Khan right down at the bottom, which is ironic because he'd be number one if this was view count. Econ Charts, not only was a box office bomb when they originally aired, but the retrospective was viewed by on average, 75% fewer people watch the Econ Shots retrospective versus all the other ones. So, I mean, you can have a look at the view counts on these. You know, about a quarter of the audience, normal audience, watched it live. About a quarter of people watched it afterwards. So poor old Econ Shots. Just, you know, bombed on re-release as well. Damn it. And then you can see the others. I will say some aspects of this list are a quirk of the way the groups came out, but it is where it is. So there you go. The people are stupid. okay, so what I've done is I'm going to go through each of the retrospectives now. And, you know, I'm mainly doing this as a kappa on these chapters of the channel. Nice to have a look back. Nice to welcome new people in. Nice to explain to people the journey a lot of us have been on. And also, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, I'll probably be making fewer kind of edited videos like this in the future. The meta has changed on YouTube. People seem to want to watch streams, you know, so people watch Unpopular Opinions and Cigar Stream and Deepest Law and Women's Hour that goes out every week. When I get the urge to write a script or whatever, I tend to write a Substack article now. And I don't know why it is, but for some reason, when you make a Substack article in writing, it tends to have, like in my experience so far, more of an impact with other creators and more of an impact with the kind of intellectual dialogue that goes on. Whereas videos are treated in a really ephemeral way for some reason. It just seems like the meta has shifted to people writing on Substack and doing streams. I'm not going to say I'll never make another video again, but this is a kind of semi-retirement from making videos. Videos, if you've never made one, take hours. You know, it's like 15, 20, 20 hours sometimes to make a video. You've got to imagine, especially my videos, which are stats heavy, researched, you know, all of this takes time, and then you have to find visuals, and then you have to record the vocals and, you know, put it all together. Sometimes it's pretty disheartening when you do all of that and, you know, like nobody watches it, basically. You know, something's changed on the YouTube algo. Videos don't seem to take off anymore for whatever reason. Even among like people who follow a channel like to watch the shows, you don't get the random traffic. It just doesn't happen anymore. And a lot of people have found that. I don't believe it's anything to do with shadow bans or anything like that. I think it's to do with the meta on YouTube. There's something, it used to be the case that a 10 minute video would be like the thing. In fact, some of these videos, some of the very, very big view count videos are only like 3 or 4 minutes long. I know at some point they changed the algo and the new meta was 20 to 30 minutes. That is why Tim Pool's videos are all 20 to 30 minutes long. If you watch some of the big channels, they follow these trends, you see, because they're chasing view counts. Steve Turley, if you look at Steve Turley's videos, they have got a little bit longer because he is riding like whatever that algo is all the time. For someone like me, I don't really want to be playing that game, because then you have to chase whatever's on trend and things like that. And I'm just not interested in playing that game. So, you know, it's a kind of a cost benefit thing. Like, is it worth investing 20 hours of my time where I could be writing a Substack, writing, you know, working on one of my books, writing a course, you know, or making a stream or whatever. So it's just that, you know, that's one of the reasons. So anyway, with each one of these, I've given a star rating similar to the old music magazines. As someone who has spent most of his 20s deeply into music, I think in terms of star ratings, right? This was also a big thing in wrestling circles, of course. You'd give a match a star rating. 5 stars is the best. Obviously, 1 star is the worst. And the Sadiq Khan stuff, I've given it 3 stars, which may be a little bit generous. You know, you could drop that down to 2.5. But really, what were these videos trying to do? That's the question you've got to ask. Like, you know, what were these doing? You know, in a way, this was my concession to clickbait, as everybody knows. And in fact, as you can see, my very last Sadiq Khan video, Sadiq Khan puts Cressida Dick on notice, got 10,000 views. Whereas my very first one, Sadiq Khan is out of control, got 126,000 views. But here's a kicker. My channel is like 10 times bigger than it was in 2018 now. So something's changed. They don't allow things like that to trend anymore. Or whatever does trend on Twitter isn't the short little videos anymore. Something happened. Something changed between 2018 and now. And so if the very reason for doing a Sadiq Khan video is a bit of clickbait to get new viewers in and to boost subs, and that doesn't work anymore, why would I do that anymore? What else were the Sadiq Khan videos doing, really? And this is why I've dropped its importance. So as you can see, I've given a rating and I've given an importance rating. So it's possible for something to be very good, like 5 out of 5, but still be inessential, because maybe the topic in itself is not that important. Sadiq Khan in himself is not that important. I think we'd all agree. Let's just pretend Sadiq Khan ran, is replaced as mayor of London by somebody else, by a Tory, for example. Is it really going to make that much difference? Like, not really. So that's one of the things that's happened. The focus on, we would see Sadiq Khan now as one replaceable node in this, he's just a, bog standard shit tier globalist of no real importance whatsoever. And so the focus on Sadiq Khan, in a strange way, all of those hit videos I did on Khan, I was kind of doing useful idiot work for the Tories, if that makes any sense. Because who benefits from this specific focus on Khan? His rivals, the Tories, benefit. So there's one video where I do a comparison between Boris Johnson and Sadiq Khan. And Johnson's crime record is better than Khan's. Well, why would I do that for Boris Johnson? You know, I shouldn't be, but like, so there's another reason to not do videos like this anymore. And it's also why these are pretty inessential, because the lens is all wrong. You know, the lens is party political, and most of us have moved way beyond a party political lens now. Still, they were fun for what they were. Let us move on. Hold on, I've got a... What is this? I've got an advert for Afghanistan refugees on my own video. On this stream, an advert for Afghani refugees just aired for me. I don't know how that happened. Here's the Tony Blair retrospective. Now, I've given that 4.5 stars. I watched through all of these as they aired, just to remind myself of the sort of stuff I'd said over the years. And this one is important. It's not essential. I wouldn't call this an essential series, but it's important. And it's important for all the reasons that I keep saying, to keep an eye on Tony Blair. And that, unlike Sadiq Khan, who is a replaceable, unimportant node, I view Tony Blair as, a dark lord, a high-ranking agent of the international gangster class. I also think that there's an extremely important video in here buried in this one, which is number four, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, Anatomy of an NGO, which basically shows in real time the power structure, the informal power structure that kind of sits above all of our governments. Above, I mean, I've seen various different maps go around. And I would say that the network of foundations, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Ford Foundation, etc., who funnel money to the NGOs, I would say that that layer is above the national government layer. These people dictate policy. They, you know, so for that video alone, I would say this is quite an important series. But also, just if you're like a complete noob to these circles, you know, let's just pretend you're a leftist who's wandered in. You may not understand how Tony Blair lied about crime statistics, how it was really Blair and Blair alone who turned the UK into a police state, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how it was Blair who justified mass immigration through pensions. All of these things, like, you know, people have this idea, oh, you know, Tony Blair, the war criminal. I never focus on the war criminal aspect. I focus on the stuff he did to the country. And so it's understanding three things about Blair. One, what he did to the country. Two, the fact that he's not just a former prime minister, but quite an important agent for Satan, and continues to be to this day. And three, the fact that his institute, the Tony Blair Institute, is quite a major node in this network of informal power that sits, I would say, above the level of national government. So, yeah, that makes the Tony Blair series, you know, important and quite good. You know, 4.5 is a pretty big rating for that series, I would say. Then there was this immigration, you know, on immigration, part three. And this came second overall. I mean, it's good. I don't know if it's like amazing. I've given it 4 stars. You know, I try to like map all of these to like Bowie albums in my mind. You know, what would it be like? Like Diamond Dogs or something. I don't know. First of all, I don't think it's important or essential, this video, this set. Okay. Everybody understands that immigration is something of a problem. This series really just quantifies it. It shows some of the economic costs and counters some of the bog standard economic arguments. And it shows the kind of social housing grift that they have going on in London, where, you know, somebody like Hackney Abbott sits as the chief on top of a local council, you know, and they, you know, her various tribe members pay her tribute as she rewards them with social housing. Yeah, I think the public may have overrated this video somewhat. I don't think it's essential. I don't think it's a 5-star work. It's notable for the Enoch Powell video at the start, which ends with a really savage montage, which got the video age restricted. It's an 18 plus because of the violence shown in that montage. But all in all, I don't think the video says much more than, yes, immigration's a problem. No, it's not a benefit. But it's like, well, who doesn't understand that in 2022? I kind of disagree with the voters. I don't think the immigration collection is that important. Let's carry on. So now we have this Deconstructing the Left series, which featured a lot of material from the anti-SJW period. I've given it the same rating as the immigration one, 4 stars. You know, it's got some good stuff in there. And now the rating, I've given it important because it is important to be aware of some of the language games the left play. And there are some pretty important bits of, you know, I talk about the Mott and Bailey, I talk about gaslighting, I talk about Kafka traps, I talk about, you know, many of the different hazing techniques that the left use, which are still important to understand for yourself. Where this collection loses points for me is one in the early videos. There's this idea that you're going to defeat the left through like argument and debate. I don't think anybody believes that anymore. I certainly don't. So, you know, I would say that some of the debate tactic stuff is no longer very relevant. Some of the later material there, you know, Another Way of Reading George Orwell's 1984, the stuff about the Adam and Sitch stuff about dishonest liberal tactics in debates, you know, The Hatchling, which was taken from Morgoth, the, you know, denying the problem and then saying, actually, that's a good thing. All of those sorts of things. I mean, it's good to codify these things, but because I don't really think debate is the name of the game, that moves this from the essential to important category. The other place that this collection loses points really is some of the cringe stuff along the way in the early period. The most hideous moment. There's a hideous moment in that early series where I play a clip from Martin Luther King and use the content of your character, not the color of the skin argument. I almost died. I wanted this when I was watching that back and that came on. I had my head in my hands. You know, we all learn. Number five was on degeneracy. Now, this came third overall, I think. Let me just check the poll. Third overall, right? Let me just double check it. Third overall. I went back to see if I'd missed something. And I really don't see what the fuss is about here. I don't get why people went wild over this. I don't even understand why it won the group, to be honest. Degeneracy's bad. It can be quantified using STD data. But I actually thought this was a pretty patchy collection. I mean, it's got like early rank punditry stuff, like the CNN trying to normalize cuckoldry. I don't really get what the crowd was thinking here. There's some decent stuff in there, but I don't see it as essential. I don't see it as important. I don't think it was I've given it the same rating. It's marginally better than the Sadiq Khan stuff, I guess, but I don't see it as being as great as all of that. So maybe someone in the comments could explain why On Degeneracy did so well, because I don't really get it. I don't really understand why. Maybe people just love Zoom, the Zoomers, Arkumas, Tom by Ab stuff, but I don't get it. We move on to the Shedding Boomer Truth era. And I actually thought that the America and Race video, when I was watching it back, has some of the best stuff I've ever done in there, in my opinion. For example, there's a video in there called Understanding the Aims and Implications of BLM. And as I was watching that back, I was like, wow, 2020 AA knocked it out of the park with that video. He really understood who BLM are, what they wanted to achieve, where they fit into the system. I think it's aged really well, that BLM video. If you go back and watch it now, 2 years later, you'll see how spot on that video was. I think the white flag, black flight stuff is really important. I think the stuff on LBJ is important. I just thought that this was a really good collection, and I was disappointed to see it lose on the Degeneracy, to be honest. And there are some pretty hard pills to swallow if you really take it, what I'm saying, into account in that series. Because they were made earlier, the LBJ segregation stuff is still like framed in based libertarian terms. I probably wouldn't frame it in the way I did back then, now in the same way, but it's still like essential material, in my opinion. If you're going to take all the pills, you need to take those ones. Yes, I would say it's really a really good collection. The only video that I didn't care for that much on the watch through was one called The American Delusion, the one that caps it off. That came out last year, and the reason that I'm not that keen on it is because it's literally just me reading out stat after stat after stat after stat for like 10 minutes straight. They just don't stop coming. That was a rhetorical technique. It was just like, look at all of the different race gaps between these two groups. I really wanted to batter people over the head with it. I don't know. I mean, at least for me, reading, listening back, I couldn't really take in all of the stats because they were coming so fast. They're shocking. They're really shocking stats. And the whole point of that video and this whole collection really is my view that the racial issue will be the end of America. I really do believe that. I do not believe that there is a solution to keeping the USA together as long as they insist on this kind of multiracial vision for the country. It's just a disaster. No regime will survive it in the long run, and I stand by that analysis. So I was disappointed that this video lost its group. It did come sixth overall, American Racism, my underappreciated work, in my opinion. Then there was the Econ Shots. Poor old Econ Shots. I don't know why. I don't know why it's never done well. But I think this Arrow was probably one of the reasons. It really is of a special interest only. I've only given it 3 stars because I actually think that there's a kind of, these videos were all like in and out in 5 minutes, you know. There's a kind of shallowness to the analysis. It's like, right, let's find the price control and then move backwards to explain the problem. You know, it's like, okay, we get the picture after the first few episodes, you get the picture, you know. Can't win them all. Then there's the economic history series. Now, I do agree with those people who say that this is some of my best stuff, and I don't know why it's done so badly in the overall voting. But I would say that it's not that important to understand why places like Venezuela, Zimbabwe, and Ethiopia went to shit, and Liberia and Haiti. You know, they've all got something else in common, of course. But I'm not convinced they're that important in the overall scheme of things. I also think that were I to make those videos today, I would have highlighted some aspects that I underplayed back in my base libertarian phase. All of these videos have a thesis, right? And the thesis is that extreme price controls on things like food, things like collectivizing land will lead to disastrous consequences. You know, right? That's the basic thesis. But there were there's a lot of other details in those there's a lot of other details in these videos that I may have highlighted more had I not been in that kind of libertarian mode. For example, a persistent feature in all of these countries, apart from Wales, is that a single even Wales, if you want to put it that way, because Wales has been dominated by the English, who are technically a different ethnic group, is that a single ethnic group dominates the other ethnic groups in these countries of diverse ethnic groups. That happens in every single one of them. I remember Bronze Age Pervert did a episode of his podcast called All Caste is Ethnic Caste, I think he called it. All Caste is Ethnic Caste. And the specifically ethnic dimension of what happens in these countries is very interesting, especially from the point of view of how it meshes with elite theory. Now, I noticed those things as I was making these videos, but they're not accentuated in the videos. And I would say they're as interesting and as important as the econ stuff. So there's that. The other thing that I downplayed in these videos at the time, which I probably wouldn't do now, is the extent of foreign interference in these countries by globalist institutions like the IMF and the US government, it has to be said. Every once in a while, a leftist will still leave me a comment on the videos talking about, well, what about when the USA did this, or what about when the IMF did that? It's a fair point, I would say, that, it kind of didn't fit with the argument I was making at that time. But were I to approach these topics now, I would look at the effects that foreign interference has in each of these places. The final thing I'll say is that some of these countries had explicitly laissez-faire policies at different times, and they still went to shit. So it's not definitely the case that it's just socialism or just price controls that lead to these places being as poor as they have been. And in fact, making this series was one of the things that made me realize that maybe the answer to a lot of these things cannot be economic. I'm not convinced that any economic system will help would help the residents of Zimbabwe turn it into Wakanda, or Ethiopia, or Liberia, or Haiti. I just have the. It just seems to me that whatever system they had, they turn it to rubble. I have yet to see a counterexample to that claim. By the same token, if you took a group of Europeans and gave them Zimbabwe, they turn it back to Rhodesia in like 5 years. Why is that? A lot of people in the chat, which I can't see, by the way, I can't see the chat, but a lot of people in the chat will be pointing to IQ, of course. But I'm not even convinced that IQ is the reason. I just think that people will conform to whatever their biospirit is, right? Biospirit. These people, the people of these African nations, if you want to put it that way, need to create their own forms. Okay, they need to create their own forms in Spengler's terms, right? Their own culture and their own forms. The imposition of European cultures and forms onto them is always going to fail. just as the imposition of African cultures and forms on Europeans is always going to fail. It has to come from them. And it won't look like, it will not look like European civilizational culture. The African civilization and culture has to be its own thing. And it will be its own thing if it's ever allowed to be. But by the same token, you have to let Europeans be Europeans. And there's potentially a bit of a contradiction in there, because Europeans being Europeans are inherently Faustian and expansive. And, you know, if you allow Europeans to be Europeans, they'll start conquering other people again as well. But I suppose that's life, right? So, but anyway, those are some of the things that I didn't say back then that I probably would say now. Okay. Then we have let me just go back on that, because it's an important point, because somebody's saying, oh, polylogism. And I understand that Mises made the argument that, you know, the laws of logic are universal, and the laws of logic, you know, don't work differently in the mind of a working class man versus a middle class man, or in the mind of an African versus the mind of a European. Reading people like Vico and Spengler and various other thinkers, I actually have come to accept, even though it's a very, very difficult thing for most of us, Europeans from the 20th and 21st centuries who are used to positivism and used to scientism and things like that, very difficult for us to accept that logic may work differently for different peoples. But I kind of now do think that. And you see it everywhere, right? There's a huge amount of Chinese people who are in the British higher education system now, and all across Europe and in America as well. And they've had a lot of problems getting Chinese students to integrate, even more basic than integration on a social level, getting Chinese student just to follow basic rules, like you don't copy other students, like you don't cheat in exams, like you don't, you don't just pass in the same piece of work as your fellow student. Now, I just have the idea that there's something in the Chinese character that makes their logic work differently from ours, right? We are used to thinking in terms of the individual unit, right, and the individual person. So my exam is mine and his exam is his. Whereas, I think BAP or D or one of these people who tends to be down on the Bugman Chinese has said, like, well, the Chinese are kind of like the Borg, you know, they have a hive mind. They're used to thinking together, you know. They don't make these kind of atomistic distinctions that we do. Once you take that as read, it filters through all of their logic and all of their thinking. And this is one of the most difficult things, I would say, from Spengler and others to fully appreciate and to understand and to agree with and to come to peace with. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, that you can get a voodoo black man science and a Borg man Chinese science, and somehow that's going to work the same as the white man science, right? That's a post-colonialist argument. I'm not making a post-colonialist argument. The argument I'm making is that different cultures have their own internal logic and their own internal ways of doing things, which are completely separate from the laws of science and physics and things like that. I'm just talking about the way they think internally. And that internal logic of a culture basically filters through everything else they do. Their government structures, their political structures, their cultural structures, their art, everything. And this is why this is ultimately why Africa is full of failed nation states, because it's an attempt to make a European form, the nation state, fit with a set of people who just are alien to that way of being. It's never going to work. Evola has fantastic passages on this as well, where he makes much the same analysis, and he talks about how all of the American, like these Americans trying to make Africans, what was the example he gave? They doubled it. They were sick of Africans not working properly on the fields, so they doubled the rate of pay, thinking that this would incentivize them to work harder. And immediately, all of the African workers halved their hours because they were, oh, I've got enough to eat now. I don't need to work anymore. Again, it's just a different way of thinking, right? It's just a different way of thinking. You're not going to make those people think the same way as you do. You just can't do it. When Bowden says race is culture and culture is race, this is the sort of thing he has in mind. You're just not going to make them think the same way as you. Which brings me back to the American delusion and this video right here. It's just not going to work. Again, note, I'm not saying that one is better or worse. I'm just saying that the attempt to fit everybody else in the world into your forms is doomed to failure. You're not going to do it. You can look at other peoples in history as well. I have seen this with the Iranians, for example. If you look at the Iranians through history, there has been something like 1300-year project to Arabize Iran. Okay, the Iranians are not Arabs; they are Persians, as everybody knows. And it doesn't matter which regime, it doesn't matter which set of Arabs, it doesn't matter which strand of Islam came. The Iranians ended up Persianizing the Arabs, not the other way around. You just can't do it. You cannot make a Persian an Arab, and you can't make an Arab a Persian. They just won't do it. The Arabs will default to being Arabs 10 times out of 10. That's why you can't bomb the Iraqis into democracy by killing Saddam Hussein. It was a fool's errand. They're Arabs. They're going to be Arabs at the end of the day. To a lot of people, this will sound like what leftists call essentialism, right? Essentialism. But I think there's something deeper than that there. It's not just saying, oh, well, you know, just because you have this blood, you're biologically destined to do X, Y, and Z. I'm not talking on that sort of level. You can get an individual Arab or an individual African or an individual Persian, for example, and essentially turn them into being of a different biospirit, okay? That works on a really individual basis, okay? And it requires all sorts of special conditions to be true as well. I've talked before about how I benefited from the fact that there were no other Iranian families down my street or in my town or even in a 50-mile radius. I believe my life would have been extremely different had there been another Iranian family around, because that turns you from being an individual into being a member of a group, okay? And my thesis basically is that at a group level, you cannot turn one group into another group. It's just not possible at scale. You can do it for individuals, but those individuals have to, by the nature of the process, be kind of isolated nodes. If you go back to the America and race video, the one on white flight, black flight, if you remember, the original black residents were able to integrate into the community because there was just one of them and they wanted to fit in, right? You can always get the one individual who wants to fit in. Othello in Shakespeare, right? Othello in Venice, he wanted to be a Venetian. He was one black man in the town. Shylock in the same town belonged to a group of Jews. and he did not want to integrate, and he never would integrate. So the idea that you could have the mass conversion of Shylock and his friends was a fool's errand on the part of the Venetians, right? So I really come to believe what you can call it polylogism. I've just come to believe that each people has their own logic, and you can't change that logic. You can change many aspects of them, right, superficially, but the core of those people will not change. It's deep rooted. In fact, I think that you can even see it in America among the different groups of who are originally based on different areas. You know, the ones that attract an Albion seed. You know, like the Quakers and the Puritans and the Virginia set and so on. Even the core of those people hasn't really changed. Even now, they're recognizably the same people. And then they have the same tendencies, and they have the same sorts of arguments as well. So anyway, moving on. This is the Boomer Truth regime. This smashed all the polls, came number one. I would say it's some of the best stuff I've ever done. I think one of the things it has going for it is that it's cohesive. That is, it was designed as a series, and it has a particular visual style, but there are some, watching that back, there were some harder, that some of those episodes go a bit harder than I remembered. Especially the episode two there, The People versus Madison Grant. I mean, there's a couple of wee-lad moments in that one. But I think one of the reasons that people connect with this series so much, and why it's had such a profound impact on people, is because it really tries to get underneath the problem. It tries to kind of find the foundation, basically, of the problem of where of our current moment, if you want to put it that way. I actually forgot to put the prologue video, the intro video, Smashing the Boomer Truth Regime, into the retrospective. So if you haven't seen that, there's an individual video called Smashing the Boomer Truth Regime that basically explains, you know, it breaks it down, and I use John Lennon and Winston Churchill to do it. But I forgot to put that into the retrospective, so you only got the Deconstructing Boomer Truth series. Eventually this will be a book that I write. I don't know if I'll base the book on the video series or not, but the core of the thesis I think is obviously I think it's spot on, because I came up, you know, I kind of put it all together. Oh, let's put it that way. Came to a certain set of realizations. And I don't think that my basic thinking has changed on these videos. I still stand by everything I said in 2020 now. So, I will say that the series maybe could do with a conclusion of some sort, a kind of concluding thoughts video. It ends just like, you know, talking about the Zoomers. You know, I go through a rundown of how Boomers, Gen Xers, Millennials, and Zoomers are made. But then it just kind of ends. Maybe it needs a conclusion of some sort. I might do that. I might put that on the to-do list just to tie together some of the important threads in there. Another important aspect of this one. Yeah, people saying, if you want to make the Bowie comparison, Ziggy Stardust, that fits in all sorts of ways, because of course Ziggy Stardust was a concept album, and this very much was a quote unquote concept album, and it was designed as such. You know, it was designed with the series in mind from the start. One of the important things that this series did as well is it got people to start to question individualism and their notion of their own identity as being a quote individual, and the importance of accepting something bigger than yourself and the great chain of being. I mean, these are, you know, these are pretty fundamental principles and things to get your head around, which are extremely difficult from the vantage point of living in our moment. The boomer truth regime makes the insights I'm trying to get across extremely difficult to understand until you divest yourself of boomer truth. Because what I'm talking about, you know, looking beyond the individual, the great chain of being, is the very antithesis of boomer truth. So yeah, I do think that was, remains pretty important, a pretty important thing to get your head around. And I do remember that I shed a whole lot of audience and friends and viewers when I made this series, because there were people who just couldn't get beyond boomer truth. You know, famously, I am an individual. Everybody else was listening to Culture Club. I was into Pink Floyd. I'll still never forget it. So yeah, I stand by this, and I was kind of touch and go as to whether the audience would put this first, but in the end, it wasn't even close. So, you know, fair enough. But unfortunately, the major casualty of Boomer Truth series doing so well was this one, the on managerialism one, which is really the core of the insights that are in Populist Delusion now. You know, managerialism and elite theory and understanding managerialism and getting beyond like capitalism versus socialism as a lens and getting beyond thinking that the system is capitalist or socialist, period. All really important stuff. Thinking in terms of the basic castes in society still, which even if you say they're formally not there, in actuality, you're still there. Understanding the closeness of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, of course, as pictured. I would say that in my view, this series is as important as the Boomer Truth one. But of course, sadly, it didn't get any headlines. It lost out in all the polls and all the rest of it. I would say it's as important. You know, if the Boomer Truth was Ziggy Stardust, this one is, I don't know, Station to Station or something. It's low or whatever. But it's as important, in my view, it's as important. Okay. Then there is the Critiquing Libertarianism series. Now, this did really well in the polls, and it kind of surprised me how well it did. Watching it back, I thought it was a bit over long, and I thought it was I labored the point a bit much, and maybe I left a few too many like easy comebacks for libertarians, especially in the first part. I don't know. There were bits and bobs of it that I'm not that happy with. There are bits of it that I like a lot more. I like the 1381 John Smith stuff. But if I had a criticism, and why I've only given it 4 stars as opposed to anything higher, is that I use a lot of stats and empirical data really to advance the arguments, and you know, that Steven Pinker video, there's a lot of stats in there, and I'm showing how dishonest his stats are, and you know, I'm basically, like, there's a meta point being made. You can tell any story you want to with stats, right? But if I was to make this same series now, I don't think I'd do that. I think I would lean on other arguments, moral arguments maybe, or I would try to like blast past scientism, period. So there's just a few too many facts and figures in there for my tastes. That in-group preference versus the free market video is kind of low-key, pretty good. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's decent. It's not bad. It's a lad insane. You know, it's not bad, but it's just not quite up there with the best stuff. And it is important. I wouldn't say it's essential, but it is important, especially for those people who are looking to get out of libertarianism or see the problems with libertarianism. And despite the some misgivings I have about the tactics I used throughout, I still think that taken all together, I put a pretty robust argument against libertarianism in these videos. I find it difficult to believe how anybody could still remain a libertarian after watching those 9 videos. And in my experience, what libertarians do is they don't libertarians never take on the arguments that you actually lay out. What libertarians do is they basically throw other libertarians under the bus. So they're like, oh, that's not real libertarianism. You know, Milton Friedman wasn't a libertarian. Ludwig von Mises wasn't a libertarian. You know, what about Hopper? What about Hopper? What about Hopper? What about Hopper? I mean, that's all I fucking get, okay? Just shut up. Actually deal with the actual arguments rather than trying to, like, you know, say who is and isn't a libertarian. That's why people hate libertarians, by the way, is what I said just there. Like, you make everybody hate you when you do that. So deal with the actual arguments at hand. And I actually do deal with Hopper as well through the course of those videos. So, yes, let us continue. So this video on containment, I actually thought stood together very well as a cohesive, you know, it was a much shorter video. It was only like a 50 minute, an hour long, this one. So it was one of the shorter collections, but I think containment is not very well understood. I did a recent Substack article trying to explain it more. I try to explain it over the course of these videos. I talk about allowable bigotry, tactical bigotry. I talk about all sorts of things in there. But the reason I'm quite fond of this collection is because there are quite a few unscripted videos in there where I'm just off the cuff. And every once in a while, I make a video where I'm just pissed off at somebody. And lots of these videos are just me pissed off at some Tory boy or other. And it's just me like ranting for 10 minutes. And some of those are just satisfying to watch sometimes, you know. I just think it's fun. You know, it's fun. But I also think that containment is really important. And I've said before that not that many people get it. Like, Morgoth gets containment really well, but I don't see people talking about containment as much as they should. Yeah. And then on strategy and tactics, I mean, I gave this 5 stars. I think there's some really important stuff there. I say it's essential because this is where I lay out why all of the other tactics, the reverse Gramsci and the you know, voting them out and forming a party and going on mass protests and all the rest of it. I go through the reasons why none of these things work, while also trying to kind of give my own ideas as to what we should be doing instead. And I think there are some important videos in here, like the dialectics and no dialogue, for example, the importance of being able to move, overturn and shift the argument without really kind of doing back and forths, if that makes any sense. So for example, I think a recent example of what I'm talking about with the dialectics and no dialogue is when the conservative woman reviewed my book, The Populist Delusion, and then you have all the hundreds of comments reeing underneath, right? They're all reeing underneath. Charlemagne's got a really fun Substack where he goes through those comments and kind of responds to them and so on. They're engaging with my argument. I am not in dialogue with them, right? So even though they're disagreeing with me, we're having that debate. Do you understand? And so Overton shifts more towards our way of thinking. The left do this really well all the time, okay? The argument isn't over, take any of the typical arguments on transgender bullshit, okay? The very fact we're having the argument means it's their victory, okay? When people were arguing over whether to build the wall or not, that was Donald Trump's victory. Do you understand? It's not the argument itself. It's the fact you're having the argument that wins the day. That's dialectics. So it's really important to try to not fall into the left's dialectics and to try to drive dialectics ourselves. Does that make sense? Anyway, that's one of many important concepts in this series, like why the slippery slope is not a fallacy speaks for itself. The network of 10 strategy. I talk about alliances and the Juvenalian model. Negative vision. I try to quantify one video quantifies the total number of elites and who they are, breaks them down by profession. Another video quantifies the total number of dissidents. You know, you could do a lot with that information. So, yeah. I thought this was an underrated one as well. I should have done better in the overall ratings. And then, of course, there was the B-side, which it's just a bit of fun, really. So, yes. All right. Let us stop. I will read some super chats. Then I'll be back later on for Unpopular Opinions, which is going to be interesting. Oh, can you hear me all? Can you hear me? Oh, bugger it. Did you miss all the super chats? Which super chats did I do? Oh, God's sake. All right. Zorro says, I am deeply grateful for your Foundations of Logic course. It is top quality and I recommend it because of it, I was able to see all the holes in your anti-libertarian critiques. Boo! But thanks for the shilling of Foundations of Logic. Excellent course, although you need to study it harder because there was no holes in my anti-libertarian critiques. McClure says, I noticed that in your hatred of gay, you apply gay qualities to other groups. I'm positive they do woke things for gay sympathies, but surely commie Kurds are more conservative than any party in the West. Well, McClure, we did a whole cigar stream on those commie Kurds and the extent to which they're astroturfed and the extent to which, you know, how real are they or not. You should watch that whole stream because I believe the total number of kind of tranny commie Kurds is probably very low. But they're the ones that inevitably have pictures taken of them, you know. Glow in the Dark says, your perception on the facts and logic will affect how you interact with them. Of course. I have not gone again. Ian Giriosivo says, what do you think of the idea that logic is universal, but culture starts with different premises that cause them to end up with different conclusions? It could very well be the case. It could very well be the case. Could be. I don't know because it could be. It could be. Glow in the Dark says, if universal man is non-existent, same is for universal logic. Yeah, I mean, I think it's undeniable that each group has its own different logic and it's going to lead them into different things. I mean, it could be that, you know, one logic is closer to whatever the absolute truth is than others. Who knows? Glow in the Dark says, I'm an individual because I was told so. I believe in individualism because I was told to. Irony, in order to be an actual individual, you have to be get there yourself. Even then, you are a part of a social group. Indeed. Jacob says, Alexander Dugin had this exact same argument with Ed Dutton. Dugin said that one African could become fully Russian. Dutton, materialist science man that he is, had an epic spurg out along with his chat. Hilarious. Yeah, I would say that Alexander Dugin is, Alexander Dugin is correct that you could take a single African and make him a Russian, right? If he was totally socialized in a Russian environment and isolated from all other Africans for most of his upbringing, then he'd be Russian, right? But if he's part of an African community, there is no Russianizing the African community, period. They'll stay African. So I don't know whose side I'd be on there, probably a bit half of one and six of one, half a dozen of the other. CEO of Racism says, hey, I think part of what makes Boomer Truth so great is that everyone on the dissident right has had to come to terms with the fact that we were lied to. Once the lie is unveiled, the truth of issues like race, realism and elitism become acceptable. Yes, CEO of Racism, yes, I think so. Glow in the Dark says, leaders are individuals in the philosophical sense. Followers can never be an individual as long as they follow. So there we go. I disagree. I think that you could, for all intents and purposes, that African would become spiritually Russian, put it that way. If he'd known nothing else, right? What else could he be? But it only works for one person. It doesn't work for a group. It doesn't scale. You know, you'd have to like adopt one African and raise him in Russia or something like that, you know. So there we are. I don't know how many black people there are in Russia, of course, but I'm convinced the differentiator is mass. Basically is, you know, how many other Africans are there in that Russian town? You know, if there's a few families there, that single African has got no chance of becoming Russian. He'll stay African. Okay. I mean, one of the reasons I don't go for the hard biological determinism is because it's obvious that people can be turned spiritually. It's obvious. If people cannot be turned spiritually, right, then you have to say that the white men are biologically determined to just destroy their own culture and society. So obviously, there has to be a component that can spiritually turn a people. You have to say that. Cringewalker says, I wonder if in this relationship the Queen is Darth Plagueis, giving the Dark Lord all her secrets only to be killed while she slept. Dylan98 says, I stopped watching your content during the Boomer Truth period, started watching you again in the Trad period. Your journey has been interesting. Dylan98, I am disappointed in your journey. Why did you stop during the Boomer Truth period? That is why your training is incomplete, Dylan98. You need to complete your training and fulfill your destiny and join us here on the base side, Dylan98. It's unacceptable that you should remain stranded as some, you know, 2017 era shit-lib, blue-eyed, naive idiot. Join us, Dylan98. Join us. Tuesday, FA Tuesday says, MLK content of your character era AA is truly Hank Hill tier. I tell you that. I tell you what. Cringewalker says, AA, read Lou Kixon's Three Body Problem trilogy. It shows biospirit very precisely in East versus West minds. I'd call it Chinese reactionary literature. All right, Cringewalker, send me that on Twitter and I will check it out. I have come to the conclusion that the pure biological argument and the pure cultural arguments do not account for really what happens. I am convinced in the category of biospirit at this moment. I've been persuaded to think in these terms by people like Spengler and Evler and others. To me, it accounts for so much more. Because it allows kind of movement from one category to the other, you know. And you can actually see, like, bits of it. When black people attack somebody like Thomas Sowell, right, you know, you're so white, you're so white. What do they mean? What do they mean when they say you're so white? They mean that the biospirit of that person has been captured by European ways of thinking and doing things. And they recognize that betrayal of their own biospirit. You're never going to have that happen at a mass level. It can only happen with certain exceptional individuals who can, you know, who are raised in specific conditions, you know, to move from one biospirit to the other. And I would say that when you really bore into it, we're on YouTube, so I can't really speak that openly, but when you really look into it, I feel that if you accept what I'm saying here, it also accounts for aspects of European decline and American decline a lot more readily than the purely biological determinist argument. All right. I think that's it. I'll be back for Unpopular Opinions later on. We've got Eggy Platypus on. And I'll see you later. Goodbye.